Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club, co-presented by the club's Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum and by Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Christy Dames, the CEO of Tech Talk Studio and co-founder of Extreme Healing, and this evening's moderator for the event, Ray Anderson, Carbon Footprint Zero. Tonight, we speak with Ray Anderson, the former co-chair of the President's Council on Sustainable Development, one Time Magazine's Hero of the Environment, chairman and founder of Interface Incorporated, and author of Confessions of a Radical Industrialist, Profits, People, Purpose, Doing Business by Respecting the Earth. Ray is here to discuss the future of sustainability, a business model for sustainable works, and how you can change the future of your company by dramatically reducing emission rates. So let's get started. Ray, one of the first things I wanted to ask you is your specific aha moment, the moment when you knew that something was wrong. And I have heard you call yourself actually a recovering plunderer of the earth. And so I wanted to know about that aha moment. How did that happen? Where did that come from?
Yeah. I founded Interface in 1973 from absolute scratch, from just an idea to produce carpet tiles in America for the emerging office of the future. 21 years into that experience, the company had come through a survival. It had thrived. It was growing. It had come through a couple of recessions and was thriving again in the year 1994. And we began to hear a question from our customers we'd never heard before. What is your company doing for the environment? This was coming from architects and interior designers, people very important to us, very influential in our marketplace. And we had no answers. So we were leaving our salespeople hanging out to dry, in a manner of speaking, and with no answers for the questions. And a group in our company said, we really need answers. So why don't we get a task force together and let's see what we are doing around the world, and let's get answers. And they came to me with the notion of the task force. I said, great, go for it. They said, but we think you should launch this task force. Give it a kickoff speech with your environmental vision. Well, I didn't have an environmental vision. I didn't want to make that speech to that group. I'd never given one thought to the environment in the 21 years of Interface and 17 years before that working for other people. And I could not get beyond we obey the law, comply. But I knew that was not a vision. So I dragged my feet. I hemmed, I hawed. They stayed on my case. I relented. The date was set August 31, 1994. And come the middle of August, I have not a clue as to what to say beyond we comply. It was a propitious moment. I was sweating. And at that propitious moment, Paul Hawkins' book, The Ecology of Commerce, landed on my desk. I had no idea who Paul Hawkins was. I picked the book up, began to thumb it, and on page 19, I came to a chapter heading, The Death of Birth. Whoa. And I began to read. And I learned quickly that that was a phrase that referred to species extinction. Species disappearing into extinction, never again to experience the miracle of birth. And that was like the point of a spear. And as I read on and came to Paul's, eventually to the central point of his book, the spear just went deeper and deeper. And when I came to the central point, he made it in three parts. One, the living systems and life support systems of the earth, the biosphere itself, is in decline. The biggest culprit in this is this industrial system of ours, this linear take, make, waste industrial system, digging up the earth for raw materials, producing products that quickly end up in landfills and incinerators, take, make, waste. And then he came to the real point when he said there's only one institution on earth that is large enough and powerful enough and pervasive enough and wealthy enough to really change all that. And it's the same institution that's doing the damage, the institution of business and industry, my institution. Well, with that, you could say, in a manner of speaking, the spear touched my heart, and I was convicted right there as a plunderer of the earth. I would read Paul's book in bed at night to my wife. She was sending money to save the harp seals long before I came to Paul Hawkins' book. And I would read passages and we would weep together over the plight of the earth. There was another story. There was a story that Paul included, the reindeer of St. Matthew Island. Maybe that's too long to try to go into, but there was, to me, a metaphor for the earth, representing three ecological terms very vividly: carrying capacity, overshoot, and collapse. And for me, it became a metaphor for humankind. We are in overshoot. And what looms ahead is collapse. So the moment was, from the book.
Wow. So from a customer.
And the customers put us on this path, absolutely.
And when you knew that you had to take action, how did you start to get your head around this? Where did you start?
Right. Now, I started with this little task force, and I challenged them to lead our company to sustainability. It just stunned them. They had no idea what was coming. They thought we were going to be talking about, compliance and keeping our skirt clean and keeping the regulators at bay and that sort of thing. And I told them, no, we're going to the top of a mountain. It's called Mount Sustainability. And it's higher than Everest, and we might as well recognize it now. But we're going to climb that sucker clear to the top. And the point at the top, actually representing the zero environmental footprint towards which we aspired from the first day. Nobody knew what this meant. It was a total mystery to be solved, and sort of one revelation at a time. I read everything I could get my hands on. I read the other side as well that said things are great and getting better. And for a while, I was back and forth. Mm-hmm. I put my company on some quixotic mission to nowhere. But in the end, I was reconciled that this is absolutely the right thing to do. And as we began actually to do it, it quickly became clearly the smart thing as well. So right, so smart.
So the business decision, the business case, was the right.
It came clear very quickly when our customers began to reward us with business because of what we were doing in response to their question, what are you doing? Yeah.
And you are over halfway
there? We think so. Of course, it's a very complex equation. There are many factors to weigh, but when you weigh the apples, oranges, peaches, and tomatoes, it sort of feels like we're 60%+ of the way. Greenhouse gases, for example, the global warming issue, we're net greenhouse gases down 71% in absolute tonnage against our 1996 baseline. And in terms of intensity, that's 82% reduction in greenhouse gas intensity relative to sales, which, by the way, is the magnitude of the reduction that the global technosphere has to manage to accomplish by the year 2050, the scientists are telling us. And when people say, God, is that possible? Well, as my friend Amory Levin says, if it exists, it must be possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, so when you went in to explain this to your executive team, I'd heard you tell a story at Bioneers Conference about a year ago, and you talked about having to go into your CFO and explain to him this revelation you have had and what you're now going to do with your billion-dollar-plus company. And so we were talking media and analysts and Wall Street. I mean, this was going to affect every single person in your company, every being on the planet, and everyone who's looking at you. How did that conversation go?
Well, a lot of people thought I'd gone around the bend. And I confronted that one day. I said, you think I've gone around the bend. I want you to know I have, because our future is around that bend. And I want to remind you, I went around the bend once before, and I found carpet tiles, and we did okay with that trip around the bend. But I also want you to know that was the warm-up. This is the main event. So I never heard any more about going around the bend. But our CFO had to deal with Wall Street and with the financial analysts, and he caught a lot of grief. He really did. But we were lucky enough to stumble on the first face of the mountain and began to climb the first face, which was the lucrative face of the mountain. That is the elimination of waste. And it was a low-hanging fruit. We said to ourselves, we're going to go for zero waste. We'll measure every operation in our company against perfection. Do everything right the first time, every time. No more off quality, no more scrap, no more waste to the landfill. That's where we're going. That's perfection, and we're going to go for zero. And as we began to capture the low-hanging fruit, we accumulated the savings. And when the Wall Street guys would say to Dan Hendricks, our CEO, what is this costing you? He could look them in the eye and say, it's not costing, it's saving. So we got ahead of the cost curve very early on and stayed ahead of the cost curve. Today, those waste elimination savings are more than $400 million cumulatively through the years, and that's far more than we've spent on the R&D or the capital investments, the process changes, the employee training, the whole ball of wax. So we're still ahead of the cost curve. Cost are down, not up. Dispelling that myth, you know, that there's this trade-off between the environment and the economy. And we invested in the technologies that did not exist when we began, the research and the development, and then the deployment of those technologies. And we are today, 35% of our raw materials, for example, is coming from old carpet, recycled, closed-loop recycling. So we're getting on up that face of the mountain as well. And you look at water usage, for example, is down over 70%. We eliminated one process in our company, and water usage went down over 70%. It was the printing of carpet tiles. We used to print carpet tiles. Today we create the pattern with a computer-controlled tufting machine, and we've eliminated all the water and all the steam and all the energy that went into the printing process. So we're way up that face of the mountain. You weigh it all out, and we're somewhere north of 60.
So you had to learn about a lot of different things very quickly, and yeah. And your profit and profits rose.
Interesting. The CFO then is our CEO now. I relinquished that role to him 8 years ago. And today, when he faces those same people in Wall Street, he leads with sustainability.
Wow.
It's a better business model, and we can make the case in spades.
You know, that leads me to, I know about this, you had to create a new division called Interface Raise to... because all these businesses were coming to you and asking you, what are you doing? How did you do this? How do we do this? And I believe that there you had had in a group of an executive team from a food, major food company who was in to learn, and there were some folks that were not as excited to be there. So
It's a great anecdote. It's maybe one of the best that's come out of this whole experience. This multinational food company that shall be nameless sent 15 people to LaGrange, Georgia, to a carpet factory for cultural exposure and immersion in sustainability. One woman among the 15 people, and she did not want to be there. She was skeptical, to say the least. She was skeptical, and she was obstructive through the whole first half of the first morning. A really disruptive person in the group, and came the middle of the morning, time for a break to get to the restroom. She had to actually walk through the factory. They were in this conference room out in the middle of the factory, so to get to the restroom, she had to walk through the factory. And on her way back, she encounters this fork truck driver with this huge roll of carpet on his fork truck, and she stops him. And she says, what do you do here? In just about that tone of voice. And he said, ma'am, ma'am, I come to work every day to help save the earth. Well, it just stunned her, you know. And she started trying to draw him out, asking him questions. What do you mean, da, 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 da. And after about a couple of minutes of it, he said, ma'am, I don't want to be rude, but if I don't get this roll of carpet to that machine in the next minute, our waste and emissions are going out of control. I got to go. So he went. She came back to the conference room, and no one knew this had happened. But the interface person who's running the conference, the session, says she took a seat, a visibly different person. She sat there very quietly, in total contrast, you know, and Then after a while, she began to challenge her people. Why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we doing that? And then she told the story of herself, you know, on herself, of her encounter on the factory floor. And she said, I've never seen anything like it. You know, the alignment in a company from the very top, which I know where you stand, clear to the factory floor. So that's the only word I can think of that describes it is love. There's a chapter in the book entitled Love on the Factory Floor. I hope you'll read that one, if no other.
That's good. Yeah. Well, and I was just going to ask you about your new book, which is called Confessions of a Radical Industrialist. And in looking through it, it's not a rah-rah book about, gee, we really ought to do this. This is a nuts and bolts. This is how we did it. This is how you can do it. Can you talk a little bit about that, writing that book?
In 1998, and by that time, I had made about 150 public speeches, and I said to myself, there ought to be a book in here somewhere. So I wrote Mid-Course Correction based on the content of those 150 speeches. That was, that's what it was. Well, 11 years later, about 1,200 speeches later, I thought, well, surely there's another book here. So I thought that the first book was far more general. It laid out our general plan, but we didn't have a whole lot of specifics, frankly, to report. But it laid out the plan, and then the current book talks a whole lot more about execution, what you actually have to do to execute the plan. So it's a how-to book. I know when we started, there was none, and we sort of wrote the book ourselves, and this is it. This is the how-to book. And as I told one other interviewer, this is down in the ditches and the trenches where it smells. Mm-hmm. This is the real deal.
And, business can do what government maybe can't do. And in this last year, with the economic meltdown and so many people losing trust in business, one of the things that I started to think about was, how are we going to trust business again? Didn't business get us in this problem in the first place? How's business going to really take us out?
Well, some businesses got us in this problem, not all businesses. And the world's full of good people doing bad things and bad people doing good things, I suppose. So it's not, you can't just paint everybody with the same brush. There were some obvious mistakes made, particularly in the financial sector. But by and large, business people are good people. They want to do the right thing. My friend Deepak Chopra has a saying that people are doing the best they can, given their level of awareness. This is all about levels of awareness, and there are plenty of people who are totally unaware, frankly, of what's happening around them. And they're every day more and more people who are aware, and the level of awareness rises and throughout the population. And there's always a higher level of awareness, even for Deepak Chopra himself. There's that higher level of awareness. So that's really what it's all about. And as we become more aware as consumers, as producers, as users of products, we will demand of the system that it do the right thing. And it's now, it's possible to do the right thing. And that's, if interface is anything of any lasting value, it is an example of what can be when you get committed. And it's also a revelation of what can be in terms of a better business model. I'm absolutely convinced this is the business model of the future. Doing well by doing good is its name.
Mm. And your people are on fire in your company for what you're doing, and their participation. I've heard you say that a leader can only lead when you have the best followers absolutely doing what they do.
The followers make the leader. That's my view. I can't say that every single person in Interface gets it to the same degree. There's a normal distribution there, too. And But by and large, they know where we're going and they know why, and they understand their role in it, and they're enthusiastic about it. And if you wanted to spell out the business case for sustainability, it comes in four easy parts. Cost are down, not up. Products are better than they've ever been because sustainable design is a wellspring of innovation. Our people, to the people issue, are galvanized around this shared higher purpose. Abraham Maslow said it a long time ago. At the top of this pyramid of human needs is this need for self-actualization. Well, to me, that translates into identification with a cause bigger than ourselves, and that's exactly what this has become for the people of Interface. And finally, the goodwill of the marketplace is amazing. There is no amount of marketing at any cost, no clever ad campaign, nothing we could have done that would have created the goodwill in the marketplace that this authentic, genuine effort is creating.
And has that helped the company through the economic fluctuations?
Yeah. As the world economy approached Y2K back in 1998-1999, institutions and companies, governments around the world stopped spending money for carpets and started spending their money on computer systems, getting ready for the Y2K rollover. We were hardly through that before the dot-com collapse. And then a year later, 9/11. So there was this perfect storm of events that practically destroyed our marketplace. And the best data available says the marketplace, the total market shrank 38% from peak to trough. We were down 17% during the same period of time. So we gained market share during this terrible down period. And it was a long recession, too, not just deep, but long. It lasted into 2003. And we came out of that stronger than we went into it with the sustainability piece in place working, progressively better and better. Now we're in it again. You know, there's another. For the first of the year, our sales dropped 25%, boom, just like that, right around the world. And we responded by reducing our capacity and even people by a similar amount. But again, there's not one thought of turning back. You know, sustainability is in the DNA of this company, and it is proven every day that its superiority in a competitive business sense, in the marketplace, in the real rough and tumble of the marketplace. We're winning business at the expense of the competitor who doesn't quite yet get it.
So sustainability and doing the right thing by people and the earth could be what takes us out of this economic fluctuation and nightmare that people have been in?
I think the good companies will survive. And I don't know what to say about the bad companies.
Well, you know, you mentioned awareness. And there was a documentary that you were featured in a few years ago, The Corporation. And I was stunned to see you in that, as it was about corporate responsibility, the cost of corporations and what corporations have done to people and the planet and the soul, really. It was quite a movie. And then talking about awareness, I just saw recently where an eighth grade class in Canada saw this movie, and the filmmakers actually went back there to film these students because the eighth grade class, they were asking questions that they didn't think any eighth grader would ever ask. And they were across the board, they were aware and got it. And changing their habits, their buying habits. They walk into a store and they won't buy something unless it's fair trade. And they know. So what was the experience of that movie for you, being in that movie?
Yeah, before I answer that, I want to just give some credit to David Suzuki. David Suzuki is Canada's foremost personality in the environmental movement. They did a survey up there, and they asked, who are the greatest Canadians? And he ranked number five on the list, but the other four were already dead. So David Suzuki is the greatest living Canadian, and And Peach, those eighth graders, believe me, worship David Suzuki. But to the corporation, it was a total surprise to me. I was in Vancouver for the Globe Forum, the Globe Environmental Conference, and I got this call: would you go across town and interview these people? They're making a movie, and they'd like to interview you. Well, I learned much later that these people had been making this movie for 3 years at that time, and they had read about me in a Toronto newspaper. I'd been up there to speak at one of the schools, and some reporter came out from Toronto and interviewed me and wrote an article, and these people read the article in the Toronto paper and called and said, you know, could we get Mr. Anderson to come and interview? So I went across town, and I just did this interview on camera with these guys, and I didn't, you know, I forgot about it. And 2 years later, the tape arrives in the mail, and it is the uncut version of the movie, 2 hours and 40 minutes. And God almighty, I am all in it, you know. And, and it makes me look so good because it makes everybody else look so bad. So frankly, it was an embarrassment. But, you know, I get letters, handwritten letters. I get emails from all around the world, you know, about that movie. Mm-hmm. People see it and they're moved by it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want you to talk a little bit about greenwashing. And so many companies and people have jumped on the bandwagon, and marketing has gone crazy with, yeah, we're green, buy me. And so can you just talk a little bit about greenwashing, and is it hurting this movement of trying to do the right thing?
Yeah, without question, it's hurting. It's confusing the public. Greenwash is the opposite of authentic. It's just that simple. You know, it's that transparent, self-serving coat of green that that companies like. You know where the term comes from. It's like you can whitewash a fence, but it's still rotten. You know, a rotten fence, but it's still rotten. Or you can greenwash a bad action, and it's still a bad action, you know, for the environment. So it's this self-serving claims for mine's greener than yours. It's just that same old game, you know, mine's greener than yours. I think it hurts legitimate efforts because people don't really know how to discern between the real and the false. So, you know, God's going to get them.
Well,
I tell you, though, from my own point of view, we said, wait a minute. Early on, we said, we cannot let words get ahead of deeds. So for years, we would not let our sales force talk about this. And finally, the sales force said, we want to do something. What can we do? And we would say to them, you just go sell. You know, every time you win the business, the earth is better off because of what's happening in the factory that's making the product you're selling. And today, though, we've loosened up a good bit because we now have a story to tell, and we've equipped our people all through the company to tell the story. And actually, it's a pretty compelling story, if I do say so.
Well, I know there's a movie out now, or that's making its way out, called So Right, So Smart, which features you and your company, and features some of the greatest people on the planet, Paul Hawken and Amory Lovins and Janine Benyus, biomimicry, and a host of other CEOs that are really moving this forward. The best part about that movie was kind of wild and crazy. Can you talk a little bit about what you have in common with the Bare Naked Ladies?
Well, that's the Bare Naked Ladies are five guys, you know, and they're
great rock
musicians. Yeah, a rock band, and apparently they're environmentalists too, and they're doing their very best in their own field. Where, you know, they're doing their best to brighten the corner where they are. And they're doing a really good job of it too, and with that audiences, the young people are just, you know, eating it up.
Yeah. Are there signs of companies that like companies that you admire. Who are the companies right now that you admire in doing what they're doing, trying to get their heads around this?
Yeah. I admire Patagonia most of all. Yvon Chouinard has been at this far longer than I have. And they are genuine and in their effort and absolutely authentic. I put them at the top of my list. I think Gary Hertzberg at Stonyfield Farms, mm-hmm. the yogurt makers, now owned by Danone, the French company. But Gary still operates his company more or less independently. They're for real. They're doing really, really good work. And there are undoubtedly many, many more that I just don't know about because I do believe that that as the awareness grows, the response to that is growing in the business community, and there's a groundswell building, and I don't think there's any doubt about that. But naming specifics, it gets really hard because you have this whole spectrum, again, of companies, and the degree to which they are committed can be anywhere from hell to breakfast, you know. So.
And what about the government? Does the president understand the urgency of this? Is after everything with health care and everything that's just been going on, is he going to have what it takes now for the battle around this?
That's a really good question, and I don't think we really know. As far as his getting it, yeah, I'm satisfied he gets it. I've heard people who are close to him say that he gets it maybe better than some of the other people around him. He's on board. The political capital, though, to push across something like cap and trade is going to be an enormous challenge to summon that kind of political capital, and it's going to take the support of the public to push it through. Governments, in my mind, government's single most important role is to use the tax and subsidy system properly to internalize the externalities that are all around us, those costs to society that have been externalized from the prices of the products that are causing the damage. And by that, I mean specifically the price of a barrel of oil nowhere near reflects its true cost. You've got the cost of the wars in the Middle East protecting the oil at its source. You've got the future cost of global warming from burning that oil. And none of that appears, in the price of a barrel of oil. But the government can put it there with an enlightened taxation policy. Carbon needs to be priced. The carbon going to the atmosphere needs to be priced so that when you're burning that barrel of oil and you're putting that stuff in the atmosphere, you're paying the full cost of the damage you're doing. And to me, that's the single most important step forward that government can take. And to me, I don't care whether it's a cap and trade system or a direct carbon tax or what I think would probably be best would be some sort of a tax shift that shifted taxes away from the good things that you'd like to encourage, like your income and mine, to the bad things that you'd like to discourage, your pollution and mine. And if we could over time shift taxes in that manner, and this is not a new idea. This goes back to the 1920s when a Frenchman named Pigou talked about Pigouvian taxes. And it's that old an idea, and it's time, by God, that we got with it and began to implement it. To get the prices right. Today we have a marketplace that is totally dishonest if the prices are dishonest. So if we can get the prices right by internalizing those externalities, wars and global warming and the like, then the marketplace can begin to act on this issue and begin to make a constructive contribution to solving the biggest problem of our times, global warming.
And are carbon offsets a good thing?
They can be. They can be if they're verified. And some of them are better than others. I mean, we've got one of the best things we've ever done is literally a carbon offset. We tapped a landfill in LaGrange, Georgia for the methane. being produced by the landfill that was going straight into the atmosphere, 21 times as powerful as carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. And with the cooperation of the city there, we've kept that landfill. We're piping that methane 9 miles, and we're using it for process heat, representing about 6% of our factory's energy. And in the process, we've made that factory climate neutral on balance. With the 23 times 6%, that's 126% offset, relieving, you know, the earth of this burden. So it's a real offset, and with a little bit more spent on other kinds of offsets, we've made the whole supply chain climate neutral from the wellhead to the end of life reclamation. And today we're selling climate neutral carpet. We call it cool carpet.
Cool carpet.
Yeah, cool carpet. And we've made 83 million square yards of it since 2003.
Wow. You were the chairman of the Climate Action Project, which made 180 specific recommendations to the president in the first 100 days. What was that process like to figure out what was important here?
Right. There was this in the Clinton years, the President's Council on Sustainable Development. Okay. 10 years after the sun set on it, I had a call from one of the people from the Department of Energy who was a liaison to the PCSD from the Department of Energy saying, how would you like to reconvene the PCSD and assess the progress that the country's made? I said, I don't think we need to do that to find out there's been no progress. He stayed on the case, you know, and he said, well, let's see if we can get Jonathan Lash, who was the other co-chair, aboard too. So I agreed, and we went and we talked to Jonathan, and Jonathan decided to come aboard too. And so it was set up to be a series of meetings to assess progress. But at the very first meeting, we brought people in who represented sort of the same kinds of people who were involved with the PCSD. You had 40 people, I guess, at the first meeting. At the very first meeting, David Orr, people would know David Orr, Oberlin College, head of the Department of Environmental Science there. David said, the last thing the country needs is another report that nobody reads. Why don't we change our objective here and let's create an action plan for the next president. Mm. A 100-day action plan to jumpstart the country on climate mitigation. So the purpose of the meeting morphed instantly into this new thing. It became known as PCAP, Presidential Climate Action Project. So we spent the four, then became five successive meetings with different people involved all along the way and produced this fantastic set of recommendations, like you say, 180, and most of them, actually all of them have been researched by the University of Colorado at Denver, by the environmental law people there, and the constitutional law people to see what can the president do on his own signature mm-hmm. without Congress. And actually, mm-hmm. most of those recommendations can be implemented. Constitutional says it can be implemented by the president with a signature, an executive order. That was delivered actually to all the campaigns before it winnowed down to the two remaining candidates. But in the end, we met directly with McCain's people and with Obama's people. And then when it became clear it was Obama, Bill Becker, who was this person who started this process with that telephone call to me and was our executive director all through the process, went and sat down with John Podesta, who was managing the transition for Obama, and went through the recommendations. Now, I can't say Obama has read them. I don't know. But so far, everything that he's said in public about climate and energy has been consistent with the recommendations in that that final set of recommendations that went to them.
We have a couple of questions that came in from the internet, and one is, what isn't your company doing right yet?
Well, we got 40% of a mountain to go. I mean, we intend to go to the top, and we got some of what lies ahead is the most difficult. One face of the mountain calls for the reinvention of commerce. That is how we go to market. And it calls for going to market with the service that our products provide rather than the products themselves. Retaining ownership in the stuff, the product, the means of delivering the service. Now, what is that for carpets? Well, that's color and texture and comfort underfoot and design and ambiance and functionality. It's the acoustical control and it's the static electricity control. It's all the reasons anybody would want our carpet in the first place. Let's satisfy those reasons by selling the service rather than the stuff and retain ownership in the stuff. Well, this translates into a lease. And you would not believe how complicated it is to get a lease accepted in a marketplace. There are structural impediments galore, some of which come from the Internal Revenue Code, some of which come from the way businesses operate, separating capital and expense into two silos. And the person that runs the capital budget and the person that runs the expense budget will not pool those funds. You cannot make it happen in most cases. So there are all kinds of structural impediments, plus the fact that the cost of that approach, the costs are not compelling yet. When oil gets back to $147 a barrel, that we believe that will be an economic case for doing it that would be very, very compelling. And then we'll have to figure out how to brush aside the impediments. And so that's one. You know, that's one that it was one of the earliest things we did, create the evergreen lease, and it's going to be one of the last things that actually happens. Yeah.
So you don't really sell carpet anymore. You say you're an environmentalist who sells experiences. And
well, that would be the ideal. But today, you know, we open up a lot of conversations with that lease concept, and then we end up with a conventional transaction, but with a commitment to take the product back at the end of its life, which is the main purpose of the lease in the first place, you know, to get the products back so we can feed those recycling processes.
And you've actually designed some of your own. You've designed equipment and to be able to take back carpet now and do something that nobody's ever been able to do.
Right. When we began, you know, some of these technologies did not exist. They were only like a gleam in somebody's eye. And it took a lot of work scouring the world for existing technologies as well as, you know, creating with our suppliers and our own people the approaches that would eventually result in the technologies. But they're basically now in place, and we can see our way clear to the top of the mountain in terms of the technologies. What's really hard, though, to the question that came in, is the reverse logistics. You know, think of your body. You've got your arterial system that puts the blood out, and you've got your venous system that brings it back to the heart. Well, we're talking about a distribution system to put the carpet into the marketplace, but a venous system, a capillary system, to collect it and bring it back. And that is turning people's worlds upside down, and it's very difficult to change that paradigm. The typical response of the typical general contractor who is refurbishing a building is to rip the carpet up and send it to the landfill without a second thought. But we have to change that paradigm, and we have to get that stuff back. And that's happening every day, more and more.
We're going to be taking questions soon, so any audience members that would like to ask questions, we have microphones right here in both aisles, so please start to think about your questions, and you might want to start lining up now because we'll be taking those questions in a few minutes. And as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Clubs Inforum and the Business and Leadership Forum. Tonight we're hosting Ray Anderson, Carbon Footprint Zero. And on that note, Carbon Footprint Zero, how far off, this is another internet question, how far off of your goal from the Carbon Footprint Zero are you? And is it really possible?
Well, that's the 71% reduction in greenhouse gases, I think, is the answer to the question. Now, of course, the material itself is petrochemical material, so there's obviously carbon in that. But the way we think about it, if we are substituting recycled material for virgin material, we have negated the carbon footprint of the material by giving it its second life and its third life and so forth. So from that point of view, recycling reaches carbon neutrality. But the energy equation is the one that's most challenging to get those greenhouse gas emissions to zero. But we're 71% of the way there in absolute tons and 82% there in relative terms. So we're closing in on it. And I think we'll get there. I really do. It will require offsets, you know, to get us there. But they will be, you can believe me, they will be third-party verified and legitimate offsets.
And what about cities and city governments? What can cities do in partnering with community, but with businesses? Is this something important between cities and partnership, public-private partnerships?
God, that's, you know, you just took me beyond my area of competence. That project that with the city of LaGrange is a prime example of what can be done. But it's only an example, but there are landfills everywhere. I once did the back-of-the-envelope calculation. The United States could have gotten to its Kyoto commitment that the Senate never ratified on landfill gas alone at a profit to everybody.
Wow.
Yeah. Is that much methane going into the atmosphere from our rotten garbage that we could have gotten to the 7% reduction?
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's an important, that's important. Yeah. For cities and for any kind of local
every,
government.
Every municipality has landfills.
Great. And I'm going to move over now to some Q&A with our audience. So please, over here.
Hi, I'm Miranda. I guess one of the first questions I've had, I've got a couple here, but I'm only going to ask one. What missteps did you make along your path? And how did that change the way that you look at the choices you make for the future?
I'm sorry.
What missteps did you make along the path, and how does that change the way you make choices for the future?
What missteps? Well, you know, very early in this process, we realized that our people had to change. We had to change the mindset of our workforce. So we took people on ropes courses, and we, you know, if you ever climbed one of those poles or walked one of those high wires, it'd scare the devil out of you. But it opens your mind up. Now, when you go beyond your physical comfort zone, it opens your mind up to go beyond your mental or emotional comfort zone. And we did a lot of that. And we opened people up to change, always with the admonition, let go the past, embrace the future. It is okay to make a mistake. Just learn from it and then move on from there. And like Yogi Berra said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. Well, over the years, we have actually developed a system for measuring which way to go when you come to that fork in the road, and it's called life cycle assessment. So we're doing, you know, very detailed, in-depth life cycle assessments of material choices, process choices, and it's helping us take the right fork in the road. But we still occasionally take a wrong one. But it's fascinating, you know, to see some of the things that have come out of it that you never would have dreamed. One of my associates, Mike Bertolucci, says, you know, it's like you enter a room you've been in 1,000 times, but you come in through a different door. And everything looks different. That's the way sustainability is. Yes.
Gentleman over here.
Thank you. My name is David Broadwin. This is a question about marketing and sales and how the evolution of your company has changed the nature of your relationship with your customers. As you've gone down this journey, you represent both great products, but you also represent a commitment in terms of values and a stance in the world. And I'm wondering if that's changed the way your sales organization engages with customers and changed the kinds of customers that you are increasingly encountered as you do business.
It's really interesting, insightful question. And, of course, there's no pat answer. There are customers and their customers and their customers, and they're at all different places on this subject themselves. We find a lot of customers finding us. That's, you know, that's one very positive factor. They find us instead of us ferreting them out. And the the most dramatic example of that, I think, was a Japanese sales manager called up one day and said, I just got an order for the carpet going into the headquarters building of Daiwa House. This is this big Japanese company that makes prefabricated homes. It's 60,000 square meters of carpet tile. I did not even know there was a project. I did nothing to win the business. It fell out of the sky into my lap. And when I went and inquired as to what had happened, how it came, you know, how we got the business, I found that there was one woman in the company who had been to Chicago to NeoCon, that's our annual trade fair, and had heard you speak, heard me speak, and went home and told her CEO, we have to deal with this company because they're doing the right thing. And over the objection of his entire board of directors, they bought Interface Carpet Tile. It almost cost the guy his job. But they did it. And when word of that spread through our sales force, you know, whoa, this is really powerful stuff. But how this is used, you know, in the selling process varies widely. We do know this. Our products have to meet every test of the market, every conventional test of the market for aesthetics and for performance, and be the best there is in the conventional terms, and have this added benefit. We very seldom lead, frankly, with sustainability. We lead with, you know, what are your needs aesthetically, performance-wise, and then and sort of the gravy, you know, the icing on the cake, oftentimes is a sustainability story. In other cases, the companies that are dealing with us because of what they see us doing.
Yes, I loved your work in the corporation, so thank you for that. You had mentioned before political will. That seems to be what keeps us from progressing sometimes. When you look at the system of the Electoral College and some of the maybe not so representative government that we have, and I'm struck by the work by Jared Diamond, a book called Collapse, where if it doesn't affect the upper echelon, a whole calamity can occur. What do you think would be or have you seen any studies on the people leading the way versus our government, or the representatives maybe being the last ones to get on board? I'm thinking about initiative politics. Do you have any comments on that?
I'm afraid I don't have a contribution to make there. I love Jared Diamond's book, Collapse. And I thought his central thesis was very compelling, that societies can be thriving with socially and in serious decline environmentally, and right to the very end. Yeah. But I'm sorry, you've
That's
lost
all right.
me with
thank
that.
You. Thank you for all the work you do. You're doing it. You're leading the way.
Thank you.
Over here. I have a question about your book, actually. You mentioned it was a how-to transform into a business, into a more sustainable business, and I'm wondering how much can you generalize sustainability and still have it apply to so many different industries? Is there a way that business leaders can cooperate, or is there a model, like you were mentioning, Mount Sustainability, that applies across the board?
Can you...
How can business leaders cooperate? Is there a model to climb Mount Sustainability?
How can they cooperate? That's an interesting.
I was just interested in how sustainability can be generalized but still be applicable. Is there something that you can recommend across industries?
Well, the direct application is to supply chains. We called a meeting of our supply chain early, and we agreed the supply chain meeting, and we told them where we were going. And we said, you know, you can come with us or not. It's up to you. But those who come with us will win the business, and those who don't will lose the business. And it was amazing the effect that had. Actually, on companies much larger than ours who were part of our supply chain. So there's the company-to-company influence at work, and it's very, very powerful. You look at Walmart today and the commitment they've made with 62,000 suppliers. When they say we're going to climb their own version of Mount Sustainability, that sends a ripple through the industrial world, you know, the likes of which we've never seen before.
Thank
My question is actually to do with not the traditional sustainability things. You mentioned that the company underwent some ups and downs, and there was a time when you had to lay off some people. And I'm trying to understand how Interface, that has done such amazing things in the world of sustainability, how it actually handled that transition for the people. How are there any lessons to be learned for other companies in terms of how any specific philosophy? And
well, it's clearly very painful, but you know you have to do it. You have to sacrifice some part of the body to save the rest of the body. And so you do it as humanely as you can. You know, you help people find new work with the outplacement. You compensate them adequately in terms of the termination pay, and you keep the benefits going as long as you can. But at the end, there's a transition, and they're no longer with you. But that takes probably 6 months. So you do your very best, and I don't know how else to say it. You treat people like you would want to be treated yourself, you know, if you were in the same reverse situation.
My question goes along some of those same lines. We've heard a lot about how your company has worked a lot, very much toward the pillars of triple top line thinking with business, and we've heard what you do in terms of the planet, and we've heard what you do in terms of profit, how it helps. But I'd like to hear more about some of the people part of it and the people who work for you. And since you decided to move your company in this direction, what programs have you implemented that are different now for the people and the well-being of your people that might not have been the same as before?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have appeared on, is it Fortune's list of 100 best companies to work for? Twice. And we asked them, you know, why? And they said, well, this is a survey directly done with the people, between Fortune magazine and the people, without any intervention, you know, on the part of management. But we asked the Fortune magazine people why, and said two reasons. One was your commitment to sustainability, and the second was the training that you are doing with your people. Well, the training we were doing with our people was almost all about sustainability, so it was sustainability and sustainability in that instance. Employee training is a big part of what we do. And training people more than just about their job, but every employee at Interface has been through the training for the natural step. You familiar with the natural step? Am I looking at the right person here trying to talk into the mic, too? The natural step training was very useful in helping our people understand, you know, where we were going and why. New people coming into the company get an indoctrination in this. You know, they get a thorough exposure to it, so they get up to speed more quickly than they would just left to flounder. So employee training is the biggest piece of that puzzle, I think, that you just posed.
As we know, there's still a certain percentage of the population that doesn't believe in the notion of global warming, and I would suspect included in that percentage is probably a number of corporate CEOs. Yeah. Even if they didn't buy into the notion of sustainability, is there a way, do you believe you can talk them into implementing sustainability on strictly economic incentives?
Well, that's when I talk about the Interface example, that's what I'm talking about. But when I encounter the skepticism you're talking about, my response is, you show me your science, I'll show you mine. You know, let's compare. And the science is so compelling that there's, you know, there's something called the precautionary principle that says when you're driving down the road at 100 miles an hour and you come to a blind curve, you slow down. That's the precautionary principle at work. And the planet is telling us, you know, we're driving 100 miles an hour down the road and we're coming to a blind curve. We better slow down. and the science is backs that up, you know. So how do you convince a million CEOs, and that's about how many there are, you know. I haven't the foggiest idea, except continue to hold up the example. That's all I know to do.
Yeah, they do buy into anything that will improve the bottom line.
Yeah.
So that may be the motivation.
The business case, the business case remains cost, products, people, market.
You know, Ray, I had a question for you since you're right here in San Francisco and Silicon Valley and all of the entrepreneurs that we have here. And you're an entrepreneur. You started out as an entrepreneur. What would you say to any entrepreneur that's anywhere, especially here in the Valley, working on clean tech or anywhere? What advice would you have to give?
I'd say get out on your knees every night and thank the Lord for Rachel Carson. Because she started the next industrial revolution, and we're well into it now. 47 years, is it, since 1962.
Yeah.
Wow. And you know, and I would just add to that, there are new fortunes to be made, too. I mean, that's what entrepreneurs are all about, yep. To see an opportunity and betting whatever it takes.
So this is the innovation of our time. Working with this is the innovation of our time.
This is a new industrial revolution.
And who helps you to stay positive? How do you stay positive when so many people want to hear what you have to say and be able to get a glimmer of hope around all that? How do you stay hopeful?
Actually, you know, I love the being here. I hate the trip. The going and the coming. But I draw great strength and encouragement from just meeting people, mm-hmm. and having a chance, you know, to exchange views and maybe move the needle just a little bit. And the cumulative effect of that, when everybody goes back and does the same thing with their friends and neighbors, you know, this ripple can spread. So I love the opportunity, you know, to be a part of the solution to an enormous problem.
Well, and my last question for you for the evening is, when the president names you as the czar for the environment, when that time comes, who are you going to select to be your top three people to lead the way through all this?
Paul Hawken, John Knox, and Amory Levins.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead. Question.
Oh, wait. Are we out of time? No, we're out of time. I'm sorry. Please hook up right afterwards. And I'd like to thank you, Ray Anderson, for being with us tonight, for sharing your thoughts, and for sharing your whole journey and all the things that you've done to lead us forward, to lead business forward. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.